Hello everyone and welcome to our KrausCast webinar series. My name is Amy Beecham and I'm the Marketing Director here at Kraus Financial. Today's topic is the 2025 Desk Reference, Breaking Down Medicaid Planning in the New Year, hosted by our Vice President, Tom Kraus. First, we do have a few housekeeping items to go through. If you have any questions during today's webinar, you can go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar and we'll answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint and two important flyers can be found in the handouts section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now let's get to the presentation. Tom, I will turn it over to you.
Why, thank you, Amy. I appreciate the kind introduction, and I want to thank everyone for joining me today. Hope everyone had a great holiday season and a great beginning start to the new year. I know here at Kraus we have a lot of exciting things on the horizon, which we'll touch on later in the presentation, but really excited for the new year, the new energy, the new opportunities that, you know, kind of the changing of the year brings. So hopefully everyone's off to a great start. With that said, the 2025 desk reference, breaking down the Medicaid planning for the new year, this is a presentation that I developed 8 years ago. I determined that today, kind of aging myself here a little bit, but after law school, coming back into the organization, really wanted to dive back into, you know, the planning and how to conduct the planning. And, you know, one thing that I learned very early on is all of our planning team were assigned this big binder full of these desk references. And as I was diving back in, I really wanted to get a handle on, you know, what is on the desk reference. You know, what are these figures? Why are they important? Additionally, in this planning, there's a lot of acronyms for different terminology that's specific to crisis planning. And I really wanted to get a handle on that. So as part of my learning and kind of diving back in, as I developed this program, and I wanted to, you know, bring it to an audience that also might be learning this planning for the first time or creating a foundation in this planning. So I developed this program with the intention of kind of walking through the desk reference, going through each term, defining what it means, and kind of having a better understanding of how it all works. But this is, again, really designed as a foundational course. So if you're a more advanced practitioner, maybe it's not as applicable to you. But if you're new to this planning, I think, again, this is a great place to start. And it does dovetail into our more basics courses. So if you haven't checked those out, definitely recommend doing so. Before I jump into the presentation, just a little bit about us. Here at Kraus Financial, we developed some of the first crisis planning tools, primarily the short-term Medicaid compliant annuity, over 20 plus years ago. We brought those out to attorneys across the country, and that's kind of our distribution model, which is unique. You know, so we've been working with attorneys for a number of years. You know, we have a staff of over 40 at this point. You know, in addition to the Medicaid compliant annuity, we've also introduced some new tools, the long-term care insurance for estate planning clients or working with clients who are a little bit younger who can plan ahead of time versus having to go into that crisis scenario. Additionally, funeral expense trust, that's another tool that we'll talk about in the program today. It's a great spend down tool. It allows your client to get access to funds at the time of death very quickly, which we'll talk about more. You know, in addition to the products, we really are leaning into the technology here at Kraus. So we're developing a number of tools that you can utilize in your practice to help streamline this planning for you and your office. So that's something that we're really investing heavily in. We really want to move or push this industry forward with our investments in this space because we think, you know, we want to make life easier for you so you can do a better job out in your community, really fulfilling this need, which is a big opportunity for attorneys. So today's goals, threefold. First, like I mentioned earlier, we are going to walk through the Medicaid desk reference, which I'll talk about a little bit more as we go along in the presentation, but we're going to define the terms on this desk reference. We're going to identify what these terms mean and how they affect your client's plan for Medicaid eligibility. And also, we're going to explore the calculations involved with these figures. Some of these figures only are utilized to perform these calculations. And as Amy mentioned at the outset of the presentation, she did drop into the handout section a couple of these handouts that are applicable to actually performing the calculations, mainly the community spouse resource allowance and also the monthly maintenance needs allowance. In a number of states, we have to actually perform a calculation. In today's presentation, I will not have time to actually do the calculation, but we will talk about, you know, how it's utilized. But I will be assigning a little bit of homework if you want to dive a little deeper and look at these handouts, because they do kind of walk you through and they really put the meat on the bone of what we're talking about here today. So first off, what is the Medicaid desk reference? Well, it is really a crucial planning tool that is the starting point for all of our case design here at Kraus. This is always where our planning team is going to start the conversation when they're working with an attorney in their particular state. In front of me, have my Wisconsin desk reference, and it lays out all of the asset regulations, the income regulations, spousal impoverishment standards. It talks about some exempt assets. So it really lays the foundation or the roadmap of, you know, qualification in your particular state. How is it utilized? Well, it acts as that state-specific roadmap in developing that spend-down plan. It answers some of the questions like, how many assets can my client keep? Are there any income limitations? Is the spouse eligible for an income shift? We always advise, again, this is something you keep with you. We call it a desk reference because we always had attorneys in the past laminate it and put it near their desk so that it's always top of mind, because this is the starting point of all of the case design here at Kraus. When is it updated? This program, I developed it. January seemed like a great time because there is a big update for a number of the figures. These figures update along with inflation, so they take into account some different things, but they're updating at least twice a year. Some states update a third time each year, but in January, we're looking at the SESRA is going to update, the maximum MIMNA, the divestment penalty divisor. In July, the minimum MIMNA, the divestment penalty divisor, if not in January. And then in some states, the shelter standard and the standard utility allowance update in October. So this is a working document. It's always changing. So it's very important you're utilizing the latest figures. Where can you find your desk reference? And I do recommend downloading a copy if you don't have one in front of you already. It will help add some context to today's presentation. So go to our attorney access platform. And this is the new Bible for our team in terms of case design. Our team works within the attorney access platform to have all these resources at our fingertips, but it's here at access.krausfinancial.com where you can download a copy of your desk reference. And attorney access is a platform, which I'll talk about at the end, that gives you these resources, puts them all in front of you in a very easy to extract place. So download a copy if you don't have one already. So in the presentation today, we're going to try to answer three primary questions in terms of these terms or these figures. First, we're going to answer what. You know, what is the definition of this figure? What does it mean? In what context is this figure used? Where is this figure used? Is it state-specific? Is it the same across all states, or is there a differentiation in how the states approach these figures? And then finally, why is it important? Is it part of a calculation that we have to utilize it? You know, what does it actually mean, and, you know, where are we going to utilize this when we're putting together a case design? So as I mentioned, we're going to walk down the desk reference kind of section by section and line by line. The first section on the desk reference is asset regulations. And the first term on the desk reference, and this is going to be the same across all states, is divestment penalty divisor. First, what is it? This is going to be the figure to determine how long a Medicaid applicant may be ineligible for benefits if any prior gifts or divestments were made within that 60-month look-back period, or 60-month look-back period, 5-year look-back period, at the time of application. Each state is going to use a divestment penalty advisor that's specific to that state. And why is this important? It's going to be part of the formula used by the state to calculate the length of a penalty period, if applicable. So breaking this down a little bit further, Medicaid, in order to prevent people from just giving away their assets prior to application and then being able to qualify, they have a 5-year or 60-month look-back period from the date of application that's going to total up any gifts or divestments made within that look-back period. And if gifts were made, it's going to assign a penalty period associated with those gifts. The divestment penalty divisor, it's going to be the figure used to determine how long the penalty period will be. The divisor is, it aligns with the state's average cost of care. So in Wisconsin, the divestment penalty divisor is $10,371.78. So that represents along the lines of the average cost for 1 month stay in the nursing home in Wisconsin. So first, what constitutes a gift? A gift occurs when a Medicaid applicant or spouse transfers ownership of assets to another party for less than its fair market value. When no compensation is received, that the entire amount of that gift or transfer is going to be penalized. When less than the full value is received, there's going to be the difference in value is going to be penalized. So an example of that is, let's say an applicant gifts their son a car worth $20,000, but the son only pays them $10,000 for the car. That $10,000 difference will be potentially penalized. Gifts are going to be calculated on an aggregate basis, so we're going to total up all the gifts. And if there is a married couple, it's going to be all of the gifts from both parties. Some examples or common types of gifts or divestments that we see would be funding an irrevocable trust, where we're trying to put that money into the trust and make it the 5 years. But if we don't make it that full 5 years, that gift or that transfer to the irrevocable trust would be considered a gift. Transferring ownership of a vehicle or a home, that would be scrutinized as well. Giving cash, outright cash to family members would also be obviously a gift. So the question is, how do we calculate the penalty period if these gifts were made? Well, we're going to total up those gifts, determine the total amount of gifts made within that 5-year look-back period. We're going to divide that figure by the divestment penalty divisor, which again is state-specific. It represents the average cost of care in your particular state. And that's going to give you the result, the length of time in days or months the applicant must wait out prior to benefits kicking in. Just a quick example. Again, I'm going to lean into my Wisconsin desk reference. The divestment penalty advisor here is $10,371.78. So just for ease, let's say it was $10,000. Let's say we determined that $100,000 of gifts were made within that 60-month look-back period. We divide that 100,000 of total gifts by 10,000 for ease. That would result in a 10-month penalty period that we would be eligible for benefits subject to waiting out that penalty period of 10 months. One note here, there is no limit on the length of the penalty period. This really comes into play in the event, say, we made a gift to an irrevocable trust where we have to determine, does it make sense to wait out whatever's remaining on the penalty period that we've created? Because if we go and we apply, we can actually create a penalty period longer than 60 months. So it's a determination we have to kind of look at before we make application is what route do we want to go. So just want to make note of that. So moving down on the desk reference, the next term on your desk reference should be the individual resource allowance. And this is the amount of countable resources a Medicaid applicant it can keep in his or her name and still qualify for benefits. This is going to apply in all states, so all states have taken this approach uniformly. The figures may differ, though. But why is it important? Because we have to ensure that any excess assets are either part of a community spouse resource allowance, assuming that exists, but anything above that amount would have to be spent down. Or if there isn't a community spouse, anything above the $2,000 in most states would have to be spent down. So states They're looking at assets in two ways. There's exempt assets, which we're not concerned about being part of those limitations, and there's countable assets. So first, the exempt assets would be a primary residence, one vehicle, things found in an average home, personal and household effects, a small whole life insurance policy, and then finally, a funeral expense trust, which we'll talk about more in the presentation, up to $15,000. The assets that Medicaid is concerned with that do count towards that $2,000 limitations in most states would be checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs, stocks, bonds, deferred annuities, additional real estate, vehicles, and unfortunately, IRAs in most states would be countable. So again, in most states, it's $2,000 is the limit that the person in the facility applying for benefits is going to be able to keep in his or her name. It does differ state to state slightly, but in most states, it is that $2,000 figure. Anything above that either needs to be in a community spouse resource allowance, or if it's above that threshold, needs to be spent down. The next item on the desk reference, and this is just a continuation of the individual resource allowance. This is in the event that a couple are both in the facility at the same time. Basically, it's stating that instead of leaving each individual with their own individual resource allowance, we're going to give them a grouping resource allowance that they can utilize. This is going to apply in all states, but again, some states the figure might differ. And why is it important? Well, again, assets in excess of this allowance must be spent down prior to applying for benefits. So breaking this down a little bit further, again, as I mentioned, when a single person applying for benefits is able to keep $2,000 in his or her name, when both spouses are in the facility and applying for benefits at the same time, they're only allowed to keep a lesser amount, in most cases, $3,000. They can allocate that $3,000 between the spouses in whatever manner they please, but again, the total between the two cannot exceed $3,000. There's a separate resource allowance, which we'll talk about when one spouse is living in the community. This figure only applies when both spouses are in the nursing home. So this is, again, if both spouses are applying for benefit, this is the combined resource allowance that they're allowed to keep as a couple. So now that we've gone through the asset regulations section, we are now moving to the income regulations. The first section, or the first term under the income regulations, and one note here is you're going to see some states are going to take different approaches, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, but my desk reference looks different than the my Wisconsin desk reference, looks different than the Ohio desk reference that's on the screen here. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that is. But again, it's just how the states take different approaches to these concepts. But first, the personal needs allowance, the amount of monthly income that a Medicaid recipient may keep for small personal expenses, things not covered traditionally by Medicaid. Each state's going to have a personal needs allowance, and the amount varies state to state. Typically, it's under $100. There are a couple states that exceed that amount, I think Alaska being close to $200 or over $200. Arizona, I believe, is above the $100 figure. But most states, it's going to be a pretty nominal amount below the $100 mark. Why is this important? Well, this amount is the Medicaid recipient can use to supplement their lifestyle in the facility. So when we break this down a little bit further, when someone is receiving Medicaid benefits, their income is going to be subject to paying the nursing home bill as part of the copay. So any income that they have, and once we deduct out some various allowances and medical expense deductions, the remaining amount is going to go towards the nursing home bill as part of that copay. Medicaid, however, is going to allow people to keep a small stipend each month to help with those extra costs not covered by Medicaid. So things like haircuts, clothing, toiletries, things of that nature. One thing to be aware of here is if the Medicaid recipient does not spend their allowance each month, which most people don't have that issue because it is small and nominal, we want to make sure that we're monitoring it so it doesn't exceed that individual resource allowance, which is $2,000 in most states, because when they come up for renewal, which can be an annual process, it could disqualify them for benefits if they exceed that individual resource allowance of $2,000. So we want to make sure that we're monitoring that. We encourage the client to spend it. But again, it's such a nominal amount that usually clients do not have an issue spending, you know, $55, for example, in Wisconsin per month. So moving along, the next term on the desk reference is the income cap. And like I mentioned earlier, my Wisconsin desk reference does not have the income cap because this is not the approach that Wisconsin takes. This is an approach taken by some states and not others. But the income, it's the income threshold for determining whether an applicant qualifies for benefits. It's used in about half of the states, but only affects applicants whose income exceeds the cap. And why is it important? Well, if the income exceeds the cap, then we have to establish a special income-only trust in order to qualify. So breaking this down a little bit further, the income cap may sound alarming. It sounds like potentially a hard cap, but that's not the case. Having income above this threshold does not disqualify your client from qualifying for benefits. Rather, we just now have to establish a qualified income trust, QIT, or also known as a Miller trust. So any income exceeding the QIT or the income cap, which currently is $2,901 in most states, must flow through the trust in order to become Medicaid eligible. So what is a QIT? Well, it's an irrevocable income-only trust. We have to establish the trust in conjunction with the bank account in order to hold the Medicaid recipient's monthly income. And again, it's typically only required for the income above the threshold, which that $2,900 figure. From there, the trustee is going to distribute the allowable expenses on behalf of the applicant, things like the personal needs allowance, which we just talked about. If there's a shifting of income, which we'll talk about here later, if there's a shift over by way of the monthly maintenance needs allowance, the community spouse, if applicable, certain monthly medical expenses like Medicare subs, things of that nature, and then finally the Medicaid copay. So the trustee will distribute those funds. And one note here is any funds remaining in the trust upon the death of the recipient are going to be subject to estate recovery. But if these trusts are administrated correctly, there shouldn't be anything remaining because that all the money is going to flow in and it's going to flow out by the end of that month once we write these checks. So again, QIT, we have to establish this when the state takes the approach of having an income cap, and any income above that threshold of $2,901 must flow through the Miller Trust or QIT in order to become Medicaid eligible. Other states, they also apply a QIT gross income cap, and this one is the one that actually functions as a hard income cap. And this income cap is going to prevent Medicaid eligibility if income exceeds this figure. This is only used in a few states. A couple that come to mind, I know Colorado has this approach. There's a couple others. But Medicaid applicants whose income exceeds this cap cannot qualify for benefits, you know, despite setting up a QIT or Miller Trust if the income is in excess of this figure. So breaking this down a little bit further, some states are going to apply an additional limitation beyond the income cap for a QIT. In these states, if the gross income exceeds this cap, it's going to be really a hard cap and the individual cannot qualify for benefits. Some states have a set figure, while others are going to equate this to the state's Medicaid reimbursement rate or the facility's Medicaid reimbursement rate, which differs facility to facility. So we have to actually make contact with that particular facility to see what that figure is. But usually it has some relation, you know, getting close to what that average cost of care is. So it is a pretty high burden in most states or most cases. So that's something to keep in mind. So moving down the desk reference, we are now at the spousal impoverishment standards section. And again, this section is where a lot of these calculations come in. So I referenced earlier that we have those handouts in the handout section of today's webinar. So I want you to reference those as we kind of move through these and talk more about the calculations. So first is the Community Spouse Resource Allowance, or known as the CESRA. Well, what is it? It's the amount of countable assets that the community spouse may keep in order to qualify the institutionalized spouse or applicant for benefits. So it functions similar to the individual resource allowance, where the person in the facility is allowed to keep a certain dollar amount in his or her name. Here, Medicaid doesn't want to impoverish the spouse from an asset standpoint. We don't want to force the community spouse to give away or spend down all their assets in order to qualify. They're allowed to keep a certain dollar amount in his or her name while residing in the community. It applies in cases involving married couples. States are going to apply the rules differently. States take different approaches to how to determine this calculation. And why is it important? Because assets in excess of the allowance must be spent down prior to applying for benefits. So in most cases, we're going to leave the individual with their individual resource allowance, the community spouse with their allowance, and then anything above that figure, we have to spend down in order to qualify. So when we break this down a little bit further, in addition to, again, Medicaid asset applicants' asset allowance, community spouse is also going to be subject to an asset limitation, which is going to be a much higher figure than that $2,000 amount in most states. Any assets above that figure must be spent down in order to qualify the institutionalized spouse for Medicaid. States really take two approaches to this. In standard CESRA states, the community spouse is just going to be entitled to the standard allowance, which is going to be the max CESRA in most states of $157,920. So we don't really have to do any calculation other than, you know, determining what they're allowed to keep that full $157,920 despite whatever assets they have at the time. You know, if they have assets below the $157,920, those should be allowed to keep whatever asset amount that is at the time of application. Other states take a minimum maximum approach, so we have to actually run a calculation and determine what the CESRA is. So those states are going to, it's going to, the allowance or the CESRA amount is going to be dependent on the amount of assets the couple owns as of the snapshot date. The snapshot date is another term of art, where we're looking for the first, we can go back in time, looking for the first day where there's 30 consecutive days of uninterrupted care in a facility. That care can be in a hospital setting, and say they transition directly to the nursing home, that would count as a non-interrupted chain of days. We're just looking to, if there's a break in the chain where an individual or an applicant goes home prior to, returning to the facility, that would break the chain. So we're looking for that first day where there's 30 consecutive days, and then we're looking at their assets. We're taking a quote-unquote snapshot of their assets as of that time frame. So we're going to take the total countable assets as of the snapshot date and divide that figure in half. And then the actual community spouse resource allowance is going to fall in these states where we take the minimum maximum approach between typically $31,584 and the maximum CESRA of $157,920. So just a quick example of this would be, say, as of the snapshot date, the couple has $200,000 and one half of the assets as of that snapshot date is $100,000. Because it falls in between the minimum and the maximum, the community spouse resource allowance in this instance would be $100,000. I guess just to show the expanded limits or the ends of this would be, say the couple has $400,000 as of the snapshot date, one half of that would be $200,000, but because it exceeds the maximum CESRA of $157,920, they would only be entitled to keep that full $157,920. The rest would have to be spent down. So where does this apply? Well, most of the states are going to actually force us to do this calculation. They're not as generous. Other states, again, that take the standard approach, we don't have to perform this calculation. We're not concerned with the snapshot date. We just look at the date of application. What's the assets available? They're allowed to keep that $157,920 or however many assets they have remaining if it doesn't meet that threshold. So the community spouse resource allowance really deals with the assets that, if there's a community spouse involved or a healthy spouse at home, what assets are allowed to keep in order to qualify the applicant or the unhealthy spouse for benefits. The monthly maintenance needs allowance, it is really dealing with what that community is supposed to allow to keep in terms of income, or what they're entitled to in terms of income. Because again, you know, Medicaid devised these rules. They did not want to put the community spouse in a position where they're destitute, you know, from both an asset and an income perspective. So we don't want to put them in a position where paying for the care of the institutionalized spouse is going to cause them, you know, to be in a really hard, you know, financial hardship. So the monthly maintenance needs allowance, this is going to be the monthly income a community spouse is entitled to. It's going to apply in all states involving married couples, but the states like the CESRA are going to take different approaches to how they determine what this figure is. And why is it important? Well, it helps protect the community spouse's income and lifestyle at home so they can remain in the community and continue to live their lifestyle and put out the financial fires in his or her life. So breaking this down further, the institutionalized spouse's income is subject to limitations. The community spouse actually has an income floor. So the income floor, again, this the way it's written, the minimum maximum, it sounds like there's a minimum amount that they're entitled to and then a maximum, but that's not the case. It's actually an income floor that we're trying to determine by calculating the monthly maintenance needs allowance. So if the income of the community spouse drops below this allowance, they will receive a shifting of income from the institutionalized spouse's income dollar for dollar until that figure is met. So that would be part of that copay. That would be a deduction from the copay, is we could shift over dollar for dollar to get the community spouse's income up to this minimum threshold. Again, like the CESRA, states take two approaches to how to calculate this. In standard MIMNA states, there's just going to be a standard allowance the community spouse is entitled to, and this is typically going to be $3,948. So we don't have to perform any type of calculation. The only question is, what is the community spouse's income? If it falls below the $3,948, we're going to shift income over from the institutionalized spouse dollar for dollar to get them up to that minimum threshold. In the minimum maximum MIMNA states, we're going to have to actually perform a calculation to determine what the actual MIMNA is. So these states, three things that we have to take into account when performing this calculation. Two of those items are actually on the desk reference. And these two, the shelter standard utility allowance, which we'll talk about, are only going to be on your desk reference if the state takes this minimum maximum approach. We have to perform this calculation. So the three items, aside from the shelter standard utility allowance, the first item here is going to be the community spouse's monthly shelter expenses. And this would be things like if the married couple has a mortgage on the home, if there's a monthly mortgage payment, if there's an HOA fee that we have to pay every month. Typically, we're going to get a tax bill once a year. We're going to divide that figure by 12 to give us a monthly expense. Homeowner's insurance is also going to be taken into account in this calculation. So we're going to break down those monthly shelter expenses and determine what that figure looks like. And then we're looking at the shelter standard, which is on the desk reference, which we'll talk about, the standard utility allowance. And the actual community spouse or the MIMNA that the community spouse can be entitled to is going to fall between that $2,555, which is the minimum monthly maintenance needs allowance, and the maximum MIMNA, which is $3,948. So we have to actually determine what the actual MIMNA is in these states. So again, I'm going to point you guys to the handout. It's going to show you how to actually perform this. We're going to talk about the shelter standard and the standard utility allowance, which are the terms needed to perform this actual calculation, but we're not going to dive into a calculation on today's presentation, but those handouts are available. So just diving into these terms, the shelter standard, what is it? It's the amount of monthly housing expenses the community spouse is going to be responsible for as part of the overall shelter expenses for the couple. It's going to be utilized in states that take this minimum maximum MIMNA approach, where we have to actually run this calculation. Why is it important? Well, it's it's needed to actually conduct the MIMNA calculation. We need this as part of that final calculation. So breaking down the shelter standard a little bit further, it's going to be based on the community spouse's total shelter expenses. But of those expenses, the Medicaid agency is saying that the community spouse is responsible for a portion of those total shelter expenses. And this is going to be based on an average within the state. And for example, in Wisconsin, the shelter standard is 1,022. Across states, the average is 766.50. So they're going to be responsible for that figure, the community spouse is, without increasing their MIMNA. So that's going to be deducted from those total shelter expenses as part of this overarching calculation. So the next figure here that's part of this MIMNA calculation is going to be the standard utility allowance. And this is also going to be a standard calculation of the community spouse's utility expenses in place of their actual expenses. This is also only going to be utilized in the states that take this minimum maximum MIMNA approach. And again, this standard or this figure is only utilized really to calculate this MIMNA calculation. So when we break this down a little bit further, Medicaid, instead of looking at everyone's individual utility bills, they are just going to apply a standardized figure that represents the average utility bills, I guess, in that particular state. Because everyone's utility bills vary so much, Medicaid does not want to spend time kind of analyzing these. They're just going to apply this standardized figure. And where does this apply? It's going to apply, again, in all these states where we have this minimum maximum approach. So again, I recommend everyone take a look at the handouts to help walk you through the CESRA calculation and also the MIMNA calculation. It'll just really tie it all together once you take a look at the handouts. It's pretty easy calculation once you see the numbers in action. So moving down the desk reference, we are now at the exempt asset limits. So the first exempt asset limitation is going to be on the funeral expense trust. And this is, what is this term? It's the face value for funeral expense trust the Medicaid applicants are limited to. It's going to apply in all states, but some states have different limits. Applicants can own a funeral expense trust and below the limit still qualify for benefits. So when we break this down a little bit further, again, I mentioned this early on, you know, a funeral expense trust, this is a way to set aside some assets. It's an allowable spend down in order to pay for the eventuality of funeral expenses. And we're allowed, the applicant and his or her spouse is allowed to have these in their names. In most states, applicants can also purchase these funeral expense trusts for their immediate family members and not cause any eligibility issues. The limit's going to vary state to state, but it's $15,000 in most states. Again, a great tool to have in place because one of the benefits is we can get access to this money at the time of death rather than sticking all the money into the Medicaid annuity and then we're having to wait for the state to settle out its claim. So it's a great tool to have in place to pay for those funeral expenses. Some states do not have a limit, so the figure is going to be dependent on what the insurance company enforces. Certain states are going to require a letter of goods and services to accompany the trust, and we're able to provide those at the time of purchase. The letter of goods and services is just going to outline the actual funeral expense costs related to the burial plot, the funeral service, and other elements, so it kind of outlines what the goods and services will be at the time of utilization. So, yeah, again, we always recommend putting one of these in place or exploring this if they don't already have it in place. It's a great way to pay for these expenses, not having to dip into the families or tap the credit cards at the time of death, because usually, you know, the funeral services occur within a week or so, you know, of the death. So by having this in place, we can tap into these funds almost immediately. So a better outcome than just waiting for the annuity to be settled out where the state is typically named as the primary beneficiary. So the next item on the exempt asset limitations is going to be the life insurance limit. Individuals are going to be able to keep, in most states, a small life insurance policy with a face limit of a very nominal amount. It's going to be a whole life insurance policy. They have to have the face value at or below this figure. So breaking this down a little bit further, again, Medicaid applicants are going to be allowed to own a whole life insurance policy, but the face value has to be, in most states, $1,500 or less, which is a pretty nominal amount, so we don't see too many people pursue this. There are some states that have higher amounts, so that those states, people do have a tendency to pursue them. I believe North Carolina is one that has a higher limitation. But again, if you do have a whole life policy, it has to be at or below this face value figure. The next item on the exempt asset limits list is going to be the home equity limit. The amount of home equity that the Medicaid applicants are limited to, it's going to apply in all states, but the limit varies state to state, and this is based on the average home values in that particular state. Why is it important? Well, applicants can have equity in their home below the limit and still qualify for benefits. So breaking this down a little bit further, the home is going to be typically the largest asset owned by these applicants going through this process. Although the home is going to be considered an exempt asset, this limit is really designed to prevent someone with significant equity in their home from qualifying for benefits. And this limit is really related to equity and not the overall home value, so what they have in terms of what the equity is on that particular home. The home equity limit varies state to state, but it's currently between $730,000 and $1,097,000. So again, this really breaks down, you know, average cost of the home, but it's probably higher than that given the averages here. Some exceptions to the home equity limit, this really is when it comes into play most frequently. The home equity limit does not apply when a community spouse or minor disabled child is occupying the residence. So if we are in that community spouse situation where we have a spouse at home, we do not have to concern ourselves with this home equity limit. It's only going to affect really those single clients who have significant equity in their home and are trying to maintain the home, potentially with the intent to return home. So they're trying to preserve that asset as an exempt asset. So that's really where it comes into play. But we don't see that too often. Usually a single person, you know, once they've left their home, they usually have sold their home before the Medicaid application is made. But it does come into play if we are trying to preserve the home as an exempt asset by way of that intent to return home. So I know we covered a lot of material here in about 45 minutes. But again, I recommend taking a look back at those handouts that are part of the handout section to really put some meat on the bone for the monthly maintenance needs allowance and also the community spouse resource allowance. So before we get to some questions, I just want to talk through some new things coming to Kraus here in 2025 that we're really excited about. First, we, as I mentioned at the outset of the presentation, we're really pushing a lot of energy and a lot of resources behind our attorney access platform. And this is really the digital resource hub for attorneys who are in this planning area, who want to get into this planning area to really enhance your practice. This webinar today is going to be part of our webinar library, which keeps expanding. We are putting a lot of resources behind our continuing legal education programming. So Jim Wolverton is our director of legal education. He's kind of designing the case or designing the courses to really, you know, fulfill the needs or the asks of our attorney audience. We have all of the Medicaid planning figures and resources available. Again, the desk reference, you should definitely have an attorney access account to get the latest desk reference. We're going to always be up as these figures update. We're going to let you know and going to alert you to these updates. We also have, you know, client-facing marketing and education materials. So this will be something you can give to your clients to explain the planning, what you're doing, and how it all functions. We do have some tools that are only available to premium members, and it's an expanded offering that's only going to be available if you do have the premium option. We have a case law library that we utilize when putting together any briefs if we have a challenge at the from the Medicaid offices. So a lot of great tools. I definitely recommend getting yourself an attorney access account if you don't already have one. And if you're in this planning day-to-day, upgrading to the premium version, because it is a great resource and we continuously add to this platform. This is the hub, you know, for all of your planning needs. I mentioned this earlier, but we do have a growing CLE library. We've added some state-specific courses that are on demand. So this is a very nice tool. We keep expanding out this library. Every month, we're going to put on a CLE course that's going to be able to be rewatched. If you do have that premium membership, all of these are going to be included with that premium membership. One of the new features that we're really excited about is we are introducing Medicaid Complaint Annuity quoting tools. So this will allow you to generate a quote directly from your attorney access account. I know a lot of attorneys that we work with work after hours, kind of doing some of this casework. So instead of having to call in and wait for us to, you know, get you the numbers, you can actually do a lot of this yourself. So you can put together some good case design, you know, at your own, on your own time, or you're always backed by our team. So don't feel like you can't call us, because we're here to help still. And just another way to allow you to take advantage of, you know, these, I guess, increases in our technology offerings. Another thing that we're really pushing into is we're partnering with some preferred partners to help fulfill the different elements of this practice. For example, you know, we partnered with Atticus for practice development. So how do I structure my practice to actually do crisis planning most effectively? They can help with that, and they have some tools in our platform as well. Also, one that's been very popular is BAMBiz. It's our marketing mastery video series, just talking about some of the different ways to market these services within your community. And again, these are only going to be available to premium members, and we're going to continuously expand this preferred partners list throughout the year. And an exciting announcement for today is we just released, as of last week, our 2025 Cross Report. This is our, I guess, quintessential guide that we put out every year. I think this is year, closing in on year 15 of putting out this publication. So this contains kind of our, you know, baseline information in terms of crisis planning. We've also included some pre-planning opportunities and case studies with long-term care insurance. But this is a document that if you're in this planning area, you should definitely get the latest copy. You can claim that at krausfinancial.com/krausreport. This is hot, literally hot off the presses, so get a copy today. With that, Amy, did we have any questions come through?
All right. Thanks, Tom. I did want to point out to everyone, if you look toward the chat, I did drop the link to order your Kraus report as well. But on to the questions. So first question here. Do the community spouse's assets always need to stay below the community spouse resource allowance?
Yeah, it's a great question that usually comes up in all the basics courses when we're doing the kind of the case design or the case studies. Unlike the individual resource allowance, that $2,000 figure that comes up for reassessment, the community spouse resource allowance, after the point of qualification, the community spouse's assets are not going to be looked at any longer. So this means that if we say we establish an annuity and those annuity payments are coming back to the community spouse in, you know, relatively short order, that asset base can grow beyond that community spouse resource allowance, and we're not going to cause any potential eligibility issues for the spouse receiving the benefits. So this is good if, you know, we're working with these clients. We can kind of put those, if the client's working with a financial advisor, we can put those assets back to work, and we can start planning for the community spouse rather than worrying about, you know, maintaining any, you know, asset limitation going forward. So, yeah, it won't be an issue. It won't cause any eligibility issues if the community spouse's assets exceed what the community spouse resource allowance was calculated at the point of application.
All right, thank you. Next question here. If my client's penalty period is longer than 60 months, should we still proceed with the spend down plan?
Yeah, that's a question you have to analyze and kind of weigh out the pros and cons. Again, because the penalty period can exceed 60 months. You kind of want to analyze what the financial impact would be. Usually we see that question kind of come into play when we have made a gift or a transfer to an irrevocable Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. And then we have to weigh out whether it makes sense to unwind that and make application at that point, or do we wait out the remaining time on that penalty that we created by making that gift? So that's really, you know, it depends answer. It's specific to what the planning objectives are. But yeah, just knowing that at the time of application, we can actually create a penalty period longer than what might be remaining, you know, for that 60-month look back. It really depends on the situation.
All right. Let's do one more question here. Can you explain some of the benefits of a funeral trust?
Yeah, funeral trust, like I mentioned earlier, it's a great tool because we can get immediate access to the funds at the time of death. I think it's within a 24-hour turnaround or 1-day business turnaround, which is great because, like I said, you know, usually the funeral occurs in short order after the time of death. So having a payor source, it alleviates some of that financial stress or some of the considerations, you know, to kind of plan for that. You know, a lot of times, if you just put the money in the annuity, let's say, because the state is going to be named the primary beneficiary, usually that process to settle their claim can take weeks or months. So having a payor source readily available to kind of put that financial fire out without putting that strain on the family, it's just usually going to be a much better result. And most families, when they have them, they're really thankful that they have them because, again, it's one less thing to worry about is being able to, you know, pay for the service and not feel like they have to, you know, tap into credit cards or things of that nature. So we always recommend that families have them. And I know the families that do have them, they are very grateful that they have them because of those considerations.
All right. Thank you, Tom. As Tom mentioned, a recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your attorney access account. If you haven't already created your account, you can head on over to krausfinancial.com/join to get started. Signing up is quick and easy and gets you access to all of our latest educational content and Medicaid planning resources that Tom went through. And I want to thank you again, Tom, for your great presentation today. And thank you to everyone for joining us and for completing that post-webinar survey. I'll also mention that if we did not get to your question today, don't worry, a member of our team will follow up with you. Thank you, everyone, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.